Okay, quiz question. Who would like to give a definition of Labdho Parshanti? Besides you, sir. Besides you. Labdho Parshanti. We discussed this morning. Definition. Sure. You think you know. Definitely don't want to get a wrong answer because then it'll be terrible, right? Louder so that I can hear you. You probably got it right, but I couldn't hear what you said.
By connecting our life, God-centered life, we can have peaceful and happy life.
Okay. That wasn't so painful, was it? Do you agree with that definition? Are you agreeing or do you want to add something? You heard what he said? Near before. Could you say it a little more clearly? Speak again. Please don't be in terrible fear. Just say. Something is peaceful. Labdha means to obtain. Labdha is to obtain. Upa, shanti. Everyone knows what shanti means. Mm-hmm. Upa, just like Upanishad. Upa is to come near to. So, put them all together. And it means, please don't make us wait too long for the answer. Doesn't have to be a literal translation of it, just
obtaining or conducting our life to approaching near them a peaceful life.
Yeah. Which becomes possible when you approach the personality of Godhead, you become absorbed in thought of the personality of Godhead. Thank you very much. Yes.
Yeah, Maharaj, contrasting the meditating on the super soul and also bhakta, and you are saying that.
And then you're adding. So that's the next question that I haven't asked yet. Are there different ways that one can reach this labdho prashanti state? And the answer is yes. Now, could you please describe them?
One is that one tries to meditate on the Supreme Personality of God in the future of Paramatma.
Mm-hmm.
And another is that the bhakta directly engaged in the devotional service of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And the same, the devotional service is natural.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, so as to say, very, very, blissful also. It's basically a concomitant factor rather than by worshipping the Supreme
Lord.
The one gets shanti and other things are the byproduct in one's because of the love for the lover.
Very good. So, because the absorption in meditation on the super soul or the absorption of the mind in the state of devotion to the personality of Godhead, the rule of the transcendental realm prevails. That is, time energy is not acting. The modes of material nature are not acting. The law of deterioration, as we find in matter, it's not acting. It's ever increasing. The influence of false ego is not found. This state of affairs is factual on the transcendental plane, but it is factually revealed in a transcendentalist's knowledge of the advanced state of pure consciousness. So, Labdho Prashanti is another way of giving a simple definition, is that it's the state of consciousness of a transcendentalist, in which there is, you know, certain things are absent and certain things are present. Now, when we began this chapter, I explained there are two major components. One is this nivritti component, and another component is positive meditation upon the form of Paramatma. Then, of course, there's embellishments on both sides. Particularly, we just mentioned some of them. This meditation upon Paramatma form of the Lord alludes to the next state that follows that, which is devotional service unto that transcendent form of the Lord. So here, text 18, this nivritti idea, with connection with the supreme detachment from matter, follows. So, text 18, the transcendentalists desire to avoid everything godless, for they know that the supreme situation in which everything is related with the Supreme Lord Vishnu. Therefore, a pure devotee who is in absolute harmony with the Lord does not create perplexities, but worships the lotus feet of the Lord at every moment, taking them into his heart. What is called renunciation is linking with the Supreme, or the other way around. Where there is linking with the Supreme, that is what real renunciation is. Very same idea is discussed in the 19th chapter. The submission that Maharaj Prakshit is making to the Supreme Lord when receiving news that, even before receiving news that this snake bird will come to kill him, he's feeling such great regret and remorse for the wrong that he has done to offend the Brahmin that he's ready to give up all of his kingdom. There's only one, so the detachment from the worldliness is spirit is there, but completely dedicating himself unto the personality of Godhead is the positive step. So he announces to the sages, that's my intention. I'm going to give up my kingdom, I'm going to give up my body, and fast until death. Fixing my mind completely on the personality of Godhead. So this is Shukadev's instruction or analysis that anything that appears to be not connected to the Supreme, a transcendentalist, has no interest. He's interested in connecting to the Supreme. So godlessness is far away. So he doesn't create perplexities for himself. We'll read the purport. In the Bhagavad Gita, Mad Dhamma or Mayabodh is mentioned several times. And, according to the version of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there exists the unlimited spiritual sky, wherein planets are called Vaikunthas, or the abodes of the Personality of Godhead. In that sky, which is far, far beyond the material sky and its sevenfold coverings, there is no need of sun or the moon, nor is there necessity for electricity for illumination, because the planets are self-illuminating and more brilliant than the material suns. Pure devotees of the Lord are absolutely in harmony with the Personality of Godhead, or in other words, they always think of the Lord as their only dependable friend and well-wisher. They do not care for any mundane creature up to the status of Brahma, the Lord of the universe. Only they can definitely have a clear vision of the Vaikuntha planet. Such pure devotees, being perfectly directed by the Supreme Lord, do not create any artificial perplexity in the matter of transcendental understanding by wasting time in discussing what is Brahman and what is non-Brahman or Maya. Nor do they falsely think of themselves as one with the Lord, or argue that there is no existence of the Lord separately, or that there is no God at all, or that living beings are themselves God, or that when God incarnates himself, he assumes a material body. So he's describing what really drains the energy of misdirected spiritualists or aspiring spiritualists. The false theories of speculative scholars that confuse people. And this business of speculation being just finding delight in agitating the mind to come up with new and different ways of thinking of things, it becomes addictive. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was having discussions with Balabha. Balabha would come and approach Lord Chaitanya with different ideas. One time he came to the Lord and said, I would like to explain to you the meaning of the holy name of the Lord. And Lord Chaitanya replied, I'm sorry, I don't know many meanings. I only know he who is Hari, and he who is the tender of the cow is Govinda. I don't know so many meanings. Because it's a tendency to interpret the meaning of the holy name as this, the Kurukshetra battlefield means this, it's not really a battlefield, it's something. The struggle of life and the horses are the five senses. The chariot driver is our intelligence. It's all allegorical. This means that, that means this. And people that become trained with that kind of idea, I had a program with some, with an older Bengali group, and so I thought I would just keep it really simple. And I explained a certain section from Bhagavad Gita. And when it was over, there was a sense that they didn't hear anything that I said. And it was proven by one of the questions. The person said, can you give another explanation of this passage? I said, well, how can it be another explanation? Well, you know, Vivekananda has explained that this means that, and that means that, and that means that. We don't know many explanations. We know Bhagavad Gita as it is. Prabhupada's phrase was malinterpretations. And how what a cheating it is to take in the name of Bhagavad Gita, someone takes the position that Krishna doesn't really know how to say what he means. Although he's the authority, he's the supreme, we accept him as the supreme authority. When he says this, he means that. He couldn't have said that if he meant that. He said this, but he means that. This means that, and this means that, and this means that, and that means this. But never direct. When Krishna says, surrender unto me, he doesn't mean surrender unto me. He means surrender to the unborn and manifest within him. If Krishna meant that, Krishna would certainly have said that. He didn't say that, but the interpreters say that's what he says, or that's what he means. When Prabhupada first came to America, he brought with him the translation of Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, in three parts, and a manuscript for Bhagavad Gita, which he had planned to have published in America. Someone stole his Bhagavad Gita manuscript before it was published. And so he had to start it over again. And during that period of time when he was starting it over again, he used the Ramakrishna Mission Bhagavad Gita to speak Bhagavad Gita from. He didn't use the purports or the commentary, just the verses, because it was a very portable book. But to show the devotees what was going on, he showed them 1866 Bhagavad Gita. So Krishna says, Sarva Dharmam Parityaja Mam Ekam Sharanam Braja. Instead of saying Mam Ekam Sharanam Braja, one surrender unto me alone, the commentary says, actually Krishna does not mean to surrender unto him, but to the unborn impersonal within him. And Prabhupada made a fist, firmly placed it on the desk, said, just see what he's doing. And he read it again. Krishna says, surrender unto me. Commentary. Krishna does not mean to surrender unto him, but to the unborn, unmanifest within him. Boom! See what he's doing. He read it again. If we accept Krishna as an authority, we should accept Krishna says what he means to say. Not that he's inept and can't say what he means. Everything has to be interpreted. It's against even Sanskrit rules. You're supposed to take the direct meaning, unless, for poetic reasons, the direct meaning is not what is intended. It just doesn't make any sense, and therefore you take a secondary meaning. That's the Sanskrit rule. But if you take the direct meaning, then which is the primary meaning, surrender unto me. Mam, first person singular. Eka means one. Sharanam means surrender. Surrender unto me. The direct meaning. So, this is Prabhupada's explanation for the devotee who is in harmony with the Absolute does not create perplexities for himself. And these are some categories of perplexities. It's this malinterpretation. Or, even simpler, interpretation. Interpretation means malinterpretation when it comes to scripture. These speculative theories are simply stumbling blocks on the path of transcendental understanding. And then Prabhupada explains, apart from the impersonalists who wish to deny even the existence of a personal feature of the Lord, there are similarly speculative theories by devotees who claim that you should be a devotee, that there is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and the feature above the Supreme Personality of Godhead is some impersonal feature. He writes, such persons wrongly manufacture their own way of devotional service by open debauchery and mislead others who are simpletons or debauchees like themselves. Like during Bhaktivinoda Thakur's time, just outside of Jagannath Puri, there was one yogi forgot his name. Anyway, he was claiming that he was an incarnation of Vishnu. And he was something of a yogi with mystic powers, and he could make fire come out of his hair. He would shake his head and flames would come. So people saw the flames, they thought, wow, he must be God. Who could do this? And so he kept his ashram not in the city but outside, and his friend was Balaram, and he was Krishna. And Balaram would go inviting respectable ladies from Puri to go meet Krishna in the dead of night, and they would have rasa dance. Krishna invited his gopi friends to have rasa dance with him, and he would pollute the respectable ladies of Puri. So this was a big disturbance. So he ordered the constables to have this person arrested. They were afraid because this guy was a mystic and maybe he would zap them or something. So they wouldn't go. And so Bhaktivinoda Thakur personally went. Anyway, that encounter is described. So there are such people who they claim that they're a devotee but have some twisted presentation of what devotion means. I'm Krishna and you're Radha, and we'll enjoy together. All these non-devotees and debauchees are, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, duratmas, or crooked souls in the dress of mahatmas, or great souls. Such non-devotees and debauchees are completely excluded from the list of transcendentalists by the presentation of this particular verse by Shukadeva Goswami. The specific disturbance created by a Dharatma or crooked soul is due to his maintaining that the transcendental form of the Lord is something material. And we hear this, or some persons put this forward, because otherwise, if you don't put something like that forward, then how are you going to deal with Krishna? You can deal with Krishna if you want to be crooked, only if you can bring Krishna down to your position. That's what the nature of envy is. He who is above an individual, the envious person tries to bring them down. So one way to bring Krishna down, at least philosophically, is to say that he has a material body like we do. Since he has a material body like we do, and Krishna performs rasa dance, so we also perform rasa dance. Divine love. It goes on. But that's, Prabhupada is showing us, that's the essence. Then if Krishna has a material form, what's the point of meditating on a material form? But it's not a material form. Therefore, the state of love, to prashanti, becomes manifest for one who factually fixes their mind upon the Supreme. By the strength, next text is 19. By the strength of scientific knowledge, one should be well situated in absolute realization and thus be able to extinguish all material desires. So again, this is very high platform. Extinguish all material desires. It's not just to tolerate them. That's the first instruction of Bhagavad Gita. Their material desires, tolerate them. Tongues to Tiksha Sabharata. And then the stage above that is to neutralize them. One develops a higher taste, and so one doesn't act on the lower taste, but that experiences a higher taste. And then ultimately, as Krishna consciousness becomes fully awake, those material desires are eliminated. In that, it's like where there's light, there's no darkness. When it's fully illumined in Krishna consciousness, fully awake in Krishna consciousness, there's no scope for material desire. Material desire means desiring separately from God. And a spiritual desire is desiring in relation to God. And that's the natural condition of the soul. In that natural condition, material desires don't exist. So we can't start there. We start from tolerating and bringing our attention instead to the eternal, feeling satisfied in the eternal, and so the lower desires, the residual tendency for separate from Krishna enjoyment is reduced and then eliminated. One should then give up the material body by blocking the air hole through which stool is evacuated with the heel of one's foot and by lifting the life air from one place to another in the six primary places. So, again, this is instruction to a yogi who is meditating on the super soul how to give up his body. At will. Not just at the time of death, but voluntarily leave. So this is the expert yogi who has thoroughly practiced the control of the life air by the prescribed method of yoga system is advised to quit the body as follows. He should plug up the evacuating hole with the heel of his foot and then progressively move the life air on and on to the six places, the navel, the abdomen, the heart, the chest, the palate, eyebrows, and cerebral pit, Brahmarandra. Controlling the life air by the prescribed yogic process is mechanical, and the practice is more or less a physical endeavor for spiritual perfection. In olden days, such practice was very common for the transcendentalist, for the modes of life and the character in those days were favorable. But in modern days, when the influence of Kali Yuga is so disturbing, practically everyone is untrained in this art of bodily exercise. Concentration of the mind is more easily attained in these days by chanting of the holy name of the Lord. The results are more effective than those derived from the inner exercise of the life air. So that helps put this instruction in context with our modern situation. This is for Maharaj Parikshit. And it's not so appropriate for us, but we should understand it's a valid method, yogic method, that's joined with meditation upon the super soul. So, once again, that's not how we're instructed. We're instructed a far simpler method. From the very beginning. In that far simpler method, controlling of the mind is also required. That for us, it's prescribed number of rounds. Chanting, doing that chanting with fixed and proper attention, avoiding offenses, and maintaining otherwise a life that is regulated. And again, as the Labdho Prashanti idea was reviewed here, it's a very natural process. We can continue with the duties of life following this process, and consciousness becomes spiritualized in a very natural way. It doesn't require curtailing those natural tendencies that we have. Rather, it's purifying those natural tendencies that we have. But fixing the mind or controlling the mind is still very much required. One can't get substantial spiritual benefit from this, our contemporary process, without very careful chanting and a very regulated practices in life. not just in the student stage, in the following stages of life as well. The training of brahmacharya life or student life is meant to carry one with that same strength into the next stage of life. Not you do that. Bhaktisiddhanta explains like this. Some persons, he goes in length to describe, some persons have the idea that brahmacharya in student life is very good because it enables one, when one enters into household life, to have this like reserve of strength to allow one sense indulgence as a householder. It's like working to earn some money and then you go on a vacation or something. You spend it all. That's a very heinous idea. But some have that explicit idea. But it's not like that. It's so that one can properly execute household duties of life, and in the execution of household duties, further purification of the mind and senses will take place to such a degree that detachment from matter is not a result of detestful experience in household life, but detachment from matter has come about as a result of sustained purification of the mind and senses. So household life then becomes a period of life where serious purification is taking place to then enable one to leave household life with a very natural condition of detachment, not frustration kind of detachment. Such a horrible experience. Never want to go through that again. So detachment out of frustration leads to impersonal conception, impersonal spirit. But detachment that results from attachment to the Supreme, especially in the line of devotion, that's a very natural detachment. That's what's being described here. The pure devotee who is in absolute harmony with the Lord does not create perplexities. Yeah. One should be, on the strength of scientific knowledge, one should be well situated in the absolute realization and thus be able to extinguish all material desires. Okay. The meditative devotee should slowly push up the light there from the navel to the heart, from the heart to the chest, and there to the root of the palate. He should search out the proper places with intelligence. So this is a very subtle thing. It's like acupressure or acupuncture. You know how that works? There are meridians within the body and they're more or less in certain places, but there's exact places. And then there's subtle ways, there's even now machines that detect where that spot is, and then that's the spot. So one's intelligence, by this process that's being described here, has to be able to detect those subtle chakras Manipurika Chakra, the just below the abdomen and navel. The Anahata Chakra and Vishuddhi Chakra in the palate, root of the palate. So there are different energy centers and the life airs can move in a restful pattern based on where you focus your consciousness. The life airs follow where you focus your consciousness. It's a subtle, it requires very elevated and subtle consciousness to be able to do this. And certainly with senses that are controlled and that can be directed by a very strong and subtle intelligence. Thereafter, the bhakti yogi, so now it moves from the meditator to bhakti yogi, but the bhakti yogi should push the life air up between the eyebrows, and then, blocking the seven outlets of the life air, he should maintain his aim for going back home, back to Godhead. If he is completely free from all desires for material enjoyment, he should then reach the cerebral hole and give up his material connections, having gone to the Supreme. Now, Prabhupada explains that for this to happen, there has to be a very clear understanding of the spiritual energy of God, not just subtle material energies of God. A very identical notion is expressed earlier, where having a clear distinction, a distinct understanding of the material realm and detachment from the material realm, the spirit of detachment is made possible by a very clear understanding of the spiritual alternative. You can't enter into the spiritual realm without a clear distinction and giving up, releasing, relinquishing, letting go of the material absorption, material identification. That's the material condition of life, is the soul misidentifying with the covering of matter. And here's how Prabhupada writes here. In the Bhagavad Gita 2:59, it is said that this sort of material detachment is possible to obtain when one is acquainted with the supreme association of life, param drishtva nivartate. One cannot be free from material attraction unless he has complete understanding of the nature of spiritual life. The propaganda by certain class of impersonalists that spiritual life is void of all varieties is very dangerous propaganda, meant to mislead the living beings into becoming more and more attracted by material enjoyments. As such, persons with a poor fund of knowledge cannot have any conception of the life of Param, the Supreme. They try to stick to the varieties of material enjoyments, although they may flatter themselves as being Brahman-realized souls. As Prabhupada explains, the yogi goes to the mountain and becomes self-realized, and he comes back down and he opens up hospitals and education programs. And if it's all false and he gave it all up, why does he come back and immerse himself in it? Because it's lonely, and the soul wants social contact, so he comes back and does what a goodness social contact, and is praised as, oh, such a great soul. See how many hospitals and schools he's opening. But from the transcendentalist point of view, that's motive goodness, but it's not spiritual life. And there is a difference between a devotee opening a hospital or a school and one who's not understood Param Dham and is opening hospitals and schools. You know, it's, in other words, one's on the material platform and the other's on the spiritual platform. It may look the same, but the consciousness behind the activity is not the same. The consciousness of the devotee is, this is Krishna's energy, and I want to connect Krishna's energy with Krishna, and devotion to him is fully in the spiritual platform, just as Krishna's form are fully on the spiritual platform. My senses become purified by engaging in meditation upon him, taking up this particular service, whatever it may be. So many things may be in the category of devotional service. If the consciousness behind the activity is the consciousness of devotion to the Supreme. And otherwise the activities stay on the material platform. And even inactivity, the attempts at inactivity, stays on the material platform. So, but the Bhagavatam is giving us a nice understanding of how to perform duties, just because these are the two questions of Maharaj Parikshit, duties in general, and specifically, when one is about to leave their body, what is the duty of that person to properly meet death? So the yoga system in different degrees or stages of perfection are being identified. See if there's any questions. A little on the technical side this time around. Yeah.
Well, you're saying that one gets tolerated in the first step, and subsequently when there was higher test.
Yeah.
So what is the basis of tolerance in the first test?
The basis is instruction. And theoretical acceptance of something higher. So if I'm going to tolerate, let's say, just, you know, I have an irritation in my arm and it itches. So I can say, I choose not to scratch my arm, but even as I'm thinking I'm choosing not to scratch my arm, that's an itching sensation just seems to grow. But if I place my mind on something else, whatever it is that's causing the itching sensation in my arm, it's not drawing my attention, because my attention has gone over here. So the basis of tolerance is investing your consciousness in the permanent, withdrawing consciousness from the impermanent, investing consciousness in the permanent. Then I can tolerate the features of impermanent duality. Now it's dark, and again it'll become light, and then the light will again become dark. Now it's winter season and it'll become the summer season. I can tolerate the summer season because again it's going to become, because this is a place of duality. But it's not just wait until the other side, the other pendulum swing of duality comes around. It's investing consciousness in the eternal. So with that, there's some preliminary faith from my side, and there's some good instruction from the other side. Anything else?
You are explaining the importance of consciousness, that it is consciousness which is making any activity possible.
Yes.
I'm finding that its consciousness is rarely accompanying it. Generally, it is on the spiritual platform.
So that's a statement. Your question is? How to get more on the conscious side than just the mechanical side? That's the question?
How to shift?
Well, there is... We all have to begin somewhere. And the beginning itself is an act of submission. That you're doing this mechanically instead of that in sense enjoyment. There's some submission. Krishna sees the submission and Krishna accepts the submission. Although it's not mature. In fact, there's a lot of contamination in motivation and so many things. But there's some submission. And commensurate with that submission, there's purification. And the purification at least gives us the opportunity. I mean, one opportunity it may give us is just relief from distress. But a more beneficial application of that purification is it can give us real deeper realization of our eternal nature based upon that deeper realization of eternal nature. There's another taste besides the taste of sense gratification and the allure that goes with it. I'm experiencing over here some purification and I like that consciousness. So I'll invest more over here. And incrementally it goes forward in that way. So even if what I just described was some modest degree of submission, I'm doing this instead of sense gratification, although this may be not fully from the heart, not with full consciousness. I'm doing because I'm being advised to do. There's some submission. Even if it's experimental, I have no idea what the outcome is going to be, but I'll try. I'll just, that much preliminary faith. Adau Shraddha. Then, sadhu sangha, through the association of devotees, this other bhajana kriya I'm doing in the association of sadhus. So there's some submission, although it's to a degree mechanical, and purification. And that purification brings some realization of a higher nature, a higher purpose, a higher mission, a higher taste. So the beginning is just a beginning. And my strength in pursuing this is very much dependent upon the circumstances. If certain circumstances don't go well, my faith weakens real fast. Soft and pliable faith in the beginning stage. Therefore, that soft and pliable faith needs good incubation chamber, I mean, as far as possible, minimizing of disturbances. And even with that, faith becomes disturbed because circumstances aren't always so favorable. But that's how it proceeds. So a critical element is sadhu sangha, good association. And one should avoid taking too many risks, you know, being cavalier about one situation. One should be very careful, particularly careful in the beginning stages. Then one is likely to progress in submission. And a very important element, this comes in the Dhruva Maharaj Leela, very, very important. He had a wish to have a kingdom, and his reason for wanting a kingdom was completely material. He was insulted and he wanted to get back at the person insulting him. He wanted a better kingdom than his father. Better than his father's father. Better than his father's father's father. It was like childish. Mm-hmm. The commentary explains. Narada understood that. He tested his determination. He was very determined. So then, okay, here's a way that you can reach the personality of Godhead. And there's certain conditions that will help this to be accomplished. So, when he received that instruction from Narada, initially Narada withheld it, but when Narada gave it, he felt such gratitude that when he was practicing, although his motivation initially was, I want a kingdom, his motivation then became also, and I want a kingdom, and feeling very grateful to Narada. That gratitude grew and grew and grew so much that his material motivation just faded. He went from sakama to nishkam bhakti on the strength of gratitude. He wanted very much to fulfill the instruction that Narada gave him out of feelings of gratitude for Narada, not just so I can get that kingdom and show my stepmother a thing or two. And that, obviously, gratitude makes the heart soft, not just do something for mechanical purposes like I don't want to suffer. I'm suffering too much. I don't like suffering. I'll practice bhakti because I don't want to suffer. So there's four types of people that surrender and one wants relief from suffering. But when that suffering does reduce, what's my motivation? Not release from suffering because that's already happened. Then I lose my motivation. So it was mechanical. I'll do this so I can get that. And when I get that, I don't need to do this anymore. See you later, Krishna. Mechanical. So for some higher purpose. Where does that understanding of a higher purpose come from? It comes in a descending fashion. Gratitude. It's coming from Krishna. It's coming from representatives of Krishna who are very carefully and painstakingly making sure that I understand the transcendental destination beyond the material modes of nature and changing positions all the time. The Ferris wheel. Now I'm going up and now I'm going down. Mechanical is I want relief from distress. It's mechanical and it's mercantile. It's not with feeling. Okay, anything else? You're on. Go ahead.
Maybe you mentioned about it, the importance of regulated life. And, fixing proper attention while chanting. My question on the chanting is although we hear so much about chanting practically almost daily, and we understand the importance of chanting, and we are ready to give time also to our speech prayer.
You're ready to give time for what?
For chanting. At least we spare 2 hours around chanting, we almost give.
I missed the last word. You give time for chanting, although
almost 2 hours.
Almost 2 hours.
We are ready to give that. We're sparing time.
We're sparing time. Okay, there we go.
But even though that feelings and attention don't come, even though we don't satisfy after chanting, that just count your rounds. But it is daily you're doing, but still that feeling don't know about why I'm not improving.
Yeah. You know the answer. There's many ways to explain it, but it's one way. It comes down to the same thing. We're addicted to material enjoyment. There's no buzz of material enjoyment from chanting. The mind wants the buzz. So, or the other way of saying it is, you know, we have a jaundiced condition, and when you have a jaundiced condition, you take Misri, rock candy, and it tastes bitter because of our jaundiced condition. Because of the disease itself, it tastes, it's sweet, but the disease makes it taste not sweet. Or another example is, due to offenses, we lose a taste for the chanting of the holy name, just like a servant may offend his master. And if the master becomes unhappy with the servant, he may just reject him. But a faithful servant, even being rejected, they'll go on serving. And in due course of time, the sincerity of the service, this is our Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur Acharya giving this example. He just goes on serving the master anyway. He doesn't feel any warm, affectionate reciprocation from his master. The master actually loves the servant, but he's, you know, teaching him a lesson. So the servant goes on serving because he's his master. And in course of time, the master accepts the servant back in good graces. Or another example is one who has fever doesn't have appetite. Someone can bring some very, very nicely prepared foods when you have a fever. Oh, thank you. I have no appetite. Even though it's nourishment that will help you regain strength, you have no appetite. But by continuing to take the medicine prescribed by the doctor, over time, the fever will subside. And then when the fever subsides, one can eat a little bit. And it's still not enough to regain strength. But gradually, as the fever is more completely gone, the capacity for eating returns. And slowly one regains strength. So those are three metaphors to help, through our material experience, understand what's happening on the spiritual side. The spiritual side is, we've turned our attention away from Krishna deliberately. And for countless lifetimes, we've been living our life in that way. Attention away from the Supreme Lord. So now we're trying to turn our attention to the Supreme Lord. the material tendency is still taking us, our attention away from the Supreme Lord, even when we're chanting His name. So that's why. Now, what to do? Continue chanting. Continue taking the medicine that the doctor recommends, and gradually that the taste, the strength, the spiritual position is restored. It's like, you know, it's like a child that's impatient. A child sees something the child wants. They must have it immediately. The parents can't say, I'm busy right now, just be patient and give me a few minutes, I'll get to it. They don't understand that. Now. All right, all right, all right, all right. We're like children. Impatient. For so long, our attention has been deliberately, willfully directed elsewhere. There's a price to pay for that. And the price is, this is my diseased condition. I don't have attraction for Krishna, even that's what I want to cultivate. So I have to be patient. But that patience doesn't mean I'm going to be less enthusiastic. I'm going to be very enthusiastic. But my enthusiasm is not going to make me discouraged, so I lose my patience. How do I balance enthusiasm and patience? It's like, go, stop. Enthusiasm and patience. It's not stop. It's you recognize that there's a supreme controller, and that's and two things, and that supreme controller is not me. But because I'm trusting, I have great confidence in the process of bhakti, and the object of bhakti, Krishna. Because of confidence, my enthusiasm can sustain. And be very, very patient. Because surely Krishna will disclose Himself. Surely Krishna will be kind. And I continue to be very patient because I know I'm not at all deserving. This is a very elevated thing I want. So I have to pay the price. One wants a diamond for the price of plastic. Or cut glass. But diamonds are expensive. You want the genuine thing, you might have to be prepared to pay the price. Or be cheated. Here's a diamond. It's 10 rupees, please. Oh, thank you very much. Cheating. It's something for 10 rupees, but it's not a diamond. You want the most valuable thing. Taste for the holy name. Takes purification. Krishna can give Himself to us like that. But if Krishna gave Himself to us like that, what would we do? Our consciousness is still not prepared to receive Krishna properly. And so He holds himself until we're ready. That's purification. Where our desire is, we genuinely want Krishna. And we're really sure who Krishna is, and we're really sure we want that relationship of loving service with him. Not to be the enjoyer or something. So it's gradual. Anything else? In context of controlling senses, I said that we should regulate our life.
So, Maharaj, regulating in terms of taking special precepts, but not with according to the clause. So, actually, how regulation should go?
Did you get it? Can you repeat it?
He's saying as that a regulation, keeping the desire of the preceptor, we say that's the basis of regulation.
Yeah, that's called duty.
Duty.
Okay.
But he's saying that doesn't usually go that regulated.
That's because we're undisciplined. And so, become disciplined. That takes practice. Rupa Goswami's example is the walking propensity of a child. Within the child, even before they walk, is the capacity to walk. It's only because the walking capacity is within that practicing to walk allows them to walk. Flying capacity is not within. Mm-hmm. So they don't learn to fly, but they can learn to walk. When learning to walk, there's tumbling to the ground and then getting back up and a couple of steps and tumbling to the ground. But by practice, the walking propensity comes out, and then they can walk without tumbling to the ground. And beyond walking, they can run. They run and 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 run. But because the propensity is there. So the propensity to lead a regulated life is natural for us. This other is unnatural. It's a diseased state. Unnatural, diseased state. But propensity is there. Both propensities, because we're marginal. The tendency to be controlled by the illusory energy and the tendency to be under the protection of Krishna. We've been habituated to the material atmosphere so much, that's all we know. And to be regulated, which is, it's only the mode of goodness, it's just, you know, we're pushed by the other modes of nature. So what to do? To practice staying in the mode of goodness. And if you fall from that, you get back up again. Stick to the mode of goodness. You fall from that, you pick yourself up again and stick to the mode of goodness. Until it becomes your second nature. Just stay regulated. One of the impetuses for staying regulated is it just feels so much better. being clean is feels better than being dirty. Although there's a little bit of trouble one has to take to become clean. I'll gladly take the trouble because I just don't like the feeling of being dirty. I just don't like it. You become conditioned to the sense of happiness and goodness. And likewise, regulation is a characteristic of goodness. When trying to help people come to the stage of goodness, regulation is essential. Irregulation, you can't be peaceful. You can't be in the condition of goodness. So the initial impetus is duty. You're instructed to be regulated. But I'm not such a good disciple because I'm not so disciplined. It's okay. The instruction doesn't change. Be regulated. Okay, so now I have the force of the instruction and the propensity to be regulated is already there. The force of the instruction will help it come out. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, on the platform of ecstatic love of God, continued his daily duties just externally. He would go do his mid-time duties and so forth, just out of habit. Hare Krishna, Prabhupada Ki Jai.